What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blandford, and today I'm talking to Paul D. Miller. So I found Paul on Twitter, and y'all, I had no idea what I was getting myself into with this interview. Paul is incredible, and we cover so much in this episode. He is a professor of the practice of international affairs at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, which means that he thinks about foreign policy all of the time from a country perspective. And so we talk in this episode about his time serving in the military, in the war in Afghanistan. We talk about his time working for the National Security Council in intelligence, his time sort of in the White House doing briefings in intelligence. And this episode is just a really clear picture of how love for the common good, love for one's country can mesh with a Christian understanding, and not in like a nationalistic sort of way, which is what we're seeing a lot out there these days, but like a real bringing about the common good for all people. And you just see a passion in that in this episode, and you just see this trajectory leading to an incredible career thinking about things that need to be thought about for all people. And so there is a lot in this episode. I said it was sort of like drinking from a water hose a little bit, and I think you're just going to get so much out of this. You're going to learn so much. I highly encourage you to follow Paul on Twitter. Just so much good stuff and so much to learn in this episode. And I think learning is always very valuable. So I can't wait for you to hear from him. Before we get to the episode, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blandford, just to stay up to date with the amazing things we got going on, the amazing people that are coming on the podcast, and just to know what's going on. And yeah, go ahead and do all that. And I really hope you enjoy hearing from Paul. All right. Well, Paul, thanks so much for making time for me. It's really nice to meet you and get to chat a little bit.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
For sure. Okay, let's just start off by having you introduce yourself to everybody a little bit.
Gosh, where to begin? So I currently am a professor of the practice of international affairs at Georgetown University, where I teach about international affairs and public service, training the next generation of diplomats. How I got there is just an interesting and fun story. I studied political philosophy as an undergraduate, actually here at Georgetown. Okay. Then I did a master's degree in public policy at the Kennedy School at Harvard. And then I joined the Army, of all things. I was 22 years old and I had sort of done nothing with my life but read and write. And I kind of felt like I could do more and so I should do more. Just felt a responsibility. And so I joined the Army, and that was about 18 months before 9/11. And so I finished up my master's degree, and my first job out of college was some Army training, and I was in the Army on 9/11. I was at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. Huh. And so I ended up in Afghanistan in 2002 as an intelligence analyst supporting the war effort. I really spent almost a decade in public service working on the war in Afghanistan from a variety of different positions. After my tour of active duty, I worked for the CIA as an intelligence analyst, and then they detailed me over to the White House, where I worked as the director for Afghanistan and Pakistan policy on the NSC staff for both President Bush and President Obama. Kind of just worked through the transition there.
Yeah.
So that's 10 years right there. Public service, working in Afghanistan. So honor and a privilege to do that. More I can say there about kind of what we did right, what we did wrong. But I also was working on my PhD at nighttime during those 10 years. Wow. And so at the end of that, I took 6 months of academic leave, finished the dissertation, quit my job, and then I went to work teaching and writing at a couple of different universities, and I've ended up here at Georgetown. And I've put out a handful of books, mostly informed by my experience, but kind of branching out as well. So the one that just came out is a book on just war, about sort of the rights and wrongs of when you go to war and what you're supposed to do. I gave all that introduction. I didn't say some of the most important stuff, I think. I'm a Christian. And so when I think about war and peace, yeah, when I think about foreign policy, I have to think about justice as I understand it, from the Bible and from sort of the great tradition of church thinking on these things. And when I think about grand strategy, I think in the same terms about what's right and wrong, drawn from my understanding of the Bible. So that's me in a nutshell. And there's more I could say, but I should stop now.
Well, that's, I mean, that's great. There's like so much packed into that that span of time. And so I would love to, you going into the Army after graduate school is interesting to me. Do you mind talking a little bit about the, like delving into that a little bit deeper?
So I actually joined up in the middle of grad school before I was actually even done.
Wow.
Again, I went straight from undergrad to a master's degree. So I was in my fifth consecutive year of college, and I was feeling a little impatient to like get a start on life and experience the world. I was young and just eager for adventure.
Sure.
And I said I wanted to branch out. I wanted to kind of broaden my horizons, and I felt like I was able to do more than just sit in school. Look, I'm good at school. I'm a professor now. This is what I do. This is kind of who I am. But I also felt like there's something more. And so I wanted to explore that more meant and felt like I had a duty to do so. You know, if you can, you should. And so that kind of led me down the route of public service. I'm very glad for that. I'm glad the Lord led me in that direction. I think I've never regretted that decision. It's, I think, one of the best decisions of my life. It kind of opened a lot of doors. And it really succeeded in broadening my horizons. I don't think I would have ended up where I am without that.
How did your Christianity, though, like your theological basis, play into that decision? Was it a, you know, part of the equation, or yeah?
In a way, you know, to you have been given much, from him much will be expected. Mm. And I just felt like I've been blessed with so much in life, including health and fitness. And so one way I can use that in service of others is by serving my country in the military. I did have to think long and hard about pacifism. That's a real thing. I think any Christian who serves in the military or the national security establishment should think about that. And that's essentially why I wrote the book on just war that just came out the other week. I spent 20 years thinking about that.
Yeah.
And that book is kind of the fruit of that reflection. It's not directly about pacifism, but it is the fruits of those reflections.
Yeah. I guess in reflecting on sort of my journey with that sort of thing, it's always just been easier to sort of be a pacifist in some ways, you know. It's like I guess I hadn't really ever thought about it. And I think at 22, who has the sort of chops to really think through sort of a Christian understanding of war versus pacifism and our duties in that, I guess.
You know, it's easy to go to the Gospels where Jesus says to love your enemies and turn the other cheek. But Paul also says in Romans 13 that the ruler does not bear the sword in vain. Or much earlier in Genesis 9, God gives the commission to Noah and to all of mankind. He says, you know, if whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood will be shed. And that's essentially a commissioning for all of government. It's the authorization for the institution of government to use coercion to uphold a basic sense of order and justice in the world. And so anybody who works for a government at any level participates in some sense in that divine ordinance of upholding justice and order, which does include the possibility of coercion, even possibly lethal coercion. And I think that is legitimate. That is as God has ordained it to be, and civilization would not exist without it. So we should be grateful that governments exist. They're quite often foolish and unjust and misuse their authority, but life would be even worse without them. You know, without them, that's called a failed state. And I actually spent a long time studying failed states, and I don't want to live in one at all. So I'm grateful that government exists, and we need to recognize that along with government comes its coercive power, its legitimate coercive power.
Yeah. As we were talking, you know, earlier, I guess that's just something I never really thought about, you know, in my theological formation, was how a government even like this concept of the common good, even like as a broad, general concept of like, how do we create good for all people is something that didn't come through in my tradition, in my theological formation, I guess.
And it's maybe more central to both a doctrine of civil government than we might think. And it's also more central to actually the gospel, right? Mm. The gospel isn't only about our individual salvation, you and me. It's about the coming of the kingdom of Jesus, which is a kingdom of perfect justice and perfect order and perfect peace. The gospel is kind of a political statement, right? Yeah. this world is, ain't it, right? This world is not utopia, and that there is a kingdom of perfect peace and justice coming. The gospel is the good news that justice wins, in a sense, and it wins in the person of Jesus. We, as sort of his ambassadors, ought to work for justice in this world, and that is a good commissioning that we have. But we need to understand that we're working to carry out that commissioning in a fallen world, and it will always be imperfect, and we will always, from Genesis 3, we will always reap the thorns and thistles, right? The fruits of our efforts will be frustrated because of the fallenness of the world.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And I guess maybe like the rampant individualism of sort of evangelical circles a lot of times doesn't lend itself to maybe thinking in like broader categories where salvation is sort of just me and Jesus and we're sort of on an island or something. I'm sure there's other factors as well, but yeah.
Yeah. Salvation is individual, right? Jesus does save us individually, person by person, and we should be like, it's not wrong to say that we should pursue a relationship with God. Like that's a true statement. But that's not the extent. That does not exhaust the good news, right? The good news starts with creation and it ends with sort of a cosmic redemption. You know, Romans 8, I think, about all creation groaning, waiting for the revealing of the sons of God. So the renewal of all creation is so much more than our individual salvation.
Yeah.
And we should rejoice in that and look forward to it. You know, rewind to Genesis 2, before the fall, when God makes Adam and Eve and puts them in the garden. What does he say? He says, tend and keep the garden. There's a commissioning there, even at the beginning, before the fall, to tend and keep all creation. It's kind of the purpose of our lives in a pre-fall state, is to tend and keep. It is to work and cultivate, to make the world even better. We have an opportunity to work for a better, more just, more peaceful, more verdant world, even without the fall. We're there to tend and keep. But now with the fall, there's so much more work to be done. And I rejoice that we have that work to be done. God has given us that sort of opportunity, that dignity to work and partake in his creation. And I think we should rejoice in that. And everything I've just said right now is so much more than just our individual salvation. It is something that we do because of our individual salvation. Out of the overflow of our love and our hearts and the grace we've received, we should take up this task with joy. But there's, the gospel doesn't stop with justification.
Right. I totally agree. I think it's important. It's an important, just even understanding the story, you know, like the beginning and the end, and like God's purposes throughout it all, you know, can't just be that like, you know, justification, like you say. It's a much bigger world and than we sort of live in, I guess, a lot of times. So interesting, as we were going through your bio, I've just been listening to some stuff on the recent insurrection and just the collective trauma, I think, of that. But as you were sort of talking about your bio, you were talking about being in the military when 9/11 happened. And I guess in my estimation, like, we haven't even sort of like processed a lot of trauma from 9/11, you know, like much and the ensuing wars, much less sort of dealing with what's going on in our world today. So would you mind just talking about your experience being in the military and stationed at a base during 9/11?
So I was in Fort Huachuca, Arizona on 9/11 and watched the second tower collapse on live TV. During the early hours of the attack, you know, they sent word into the classroom where we were, and we all kind of knew something was happening. But then they canceled class, marched us back to the barracks, walked in the common room, watched the second tower collapse. So I teach the folks half my age now, the younger generation, who don't quite have the same living memory. And I don't know that there's ever going to be, I don't think we're ever going to be able to communicate what it was like to watch that happen live and kind of go through that hour by hour, and then month by month afterwards. My wife, I had not yet met her, but she was working on Capitol Hill. And we later figured out that the folks on Flight 93 probably saved her life. She was in the Capitol building working for one of the members of leadership. So she was not in the Cannon building or anything. She was in the Capitol itself. And I once traced her steps at minute by minute. to the best of her recollection. And she probably would have been right there in the building or right outside when that fourth plane would have hit.
Wow.
So like that's part of our family story. And we tell that to our kids, and that will be part of our kind of our oral tradition to share that forever. To me, I've never, how do I say this in a tactful way? In the years since, it's clear that many people have turned the page and they're not invested in the continuing fight against jihadist terrorism or the war in Afghanistan the way I have been, right? I spent 10 years working on it. So it's always been deeply personal to me. I lost a friend over there in Afghanistan. And it's sometimes hard when I realize that most people just don't care, right?
Yeah.
To them, they don't care. And I've had to kind of grapple with that and come to realize that we all have our different battles to fight, our different sort of causes. When I said that we have the opportunity to work for a more just and peaceful world, you can't do it all. And you end up sort of picking a cause. For some people, it's, you know, the pro-life movement. Or for some people, it might be, you know, the war in Afghanistan for me. Or for others, it'll be, I don't know what, you know, fighting the sex trafficking trade or something like that. And so the fact that other people don't care about my cause is okay. It's taken me a long time to say that it's okay, but it is okay. I think that it is right and just that we are fighting against terrorists, and we should all care about it. But and we all benefit from that fight because there are still people on the front lines today keeping us safe, and we should be grateful for that. But at the end of the day, we can't all care about every evil thing equally. We would just burn out and become kind of embittered permanent activists if that was all our life was about. The other challenge is that the Lord does command us to love our enemies. And prior to 9/11, I didn't think I had enemies. But now enemies have a face and they have names for me. And the idea of praying for my enemies and loving them is pretty challenging. There's a verse in Ezekiel that says, "The Lord does not delight in the death of the wicked." That was an important verse for me to meditate on in 2011 after the Abbottabad raid that killed Osama bin Laden. I think it's good for us to recognize that it's good when justice is done. Yeah, I think it is a good thing that the United States eventually tracked down and executed bin Laden. But it is also inappropriate to rejoice. Like, we don't celebrate when bad people die.
Yeah.
We can celebrate that justice is done. We can celebrate if a war comes to a conclusion, but we don't celebrate the death itself. That is always a matter of lament because everyone is made in the image of God.
Yeah, I just feel like I need to let that sort of settle. You know, that's like some powerful truth. Yeah. And how much of the way that we interact as Christians on a day-to-day basis that like neglects that Imago Dei, or even like takes it away, that image bearingness of other humans with the way that we, I don't know, act on social media, but also just like think about other people, think about the poor, think about, you know, on and on. So,
yeah, I mean, to take it, this conversation to a different corner, right? So I was talking about how Christians should work for justice and all that in the world. Sometimes the way we go about doing that hurts our witness, hurts our cause, and hurts America, right? Because we all have seen how people can, in the service of a just cause, become zealous.
Yeah.
And they become crusaders. They become deeply unkind and uncharitable in how they go about pursuing their just cause. And we justify it because it's a just cause. And so like we have to fight hard and we have to, you know, defeat the other side. And that I think is, I'll put it this way. It's wrong to do that even in a state of literal war. Just wrote this book on just war. And look, you have to love your enemy in the middle of a just war. You have to fight justly in order to win justly. We call it jus in bello, the justice of how you fight, and also the justice of how you win and what you do in the aftermath. And right now I fear there's a lot of Christian activists in the American political scene who they're using the rhetoric of civil war, they're using the rhetoric of belligerency of combatants, folks who almost wish that the Civil War was happening so they could go and shoot the bad guys and shoot the progressives or whatever, the social justice warriors. And I have to say, as a scholar of just war, that's not right. But also as an American, it's not right to want civil war. That's a terrible thing. I've studied civil wars. They are ghastly, horrible things. And so we should pray earnestly that we never go down that, that whole. So yeah, I think I'd say that in how we pursue our just causes, we still must do so with love in our hearts for those who oppose us.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big demand on us as we sort of, you know, I mean, vengeance is sort of easily desired, I guess.
But that, you know, Romans 12, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
Amen. Yeah, we just, I'm studying Amos with some guys from the church, and we just had a little Bible study this morning, and we were talking about this very thing. Like, what is, like, how do we even, maybe this is too big of a topic to get into here, but how do we even talk about justice, you know? I mean, justice is mine, says the, you know, or vengeance is mine, says the Lord, but justice is God's to mete out, right? Any justice that we could do on this earth is an incomplete justice, just because we are who we are. So how do we think about maybe justice from a Christian perspective?
So Tim Keller wrote a great book some years ago called Generous Justice. And even now, I think it may be one of the best books I've read about how the Bible thinks about justice. I've read lots and lots of other books about justice. But this is a great starting point. Because Keller simply walks through the Bible and brings up almost every occurrence of either justice or righteousness, and then shows what the Bible means by those words. And those two words, justice and righteousness, are almost synonymous in the Bible. When you read righteousness in the Bible, you can just substitute the word justice. So the Bible is about righteousness. It is about justice. It's a book thoroughly about justice. And it's a complex picture that Keller paints. It does include procedural justice, you know, fairness and abiding by the rules and abiding by law. That's part of justice.
Yeah.
But it goes more than that. It also includes right relationships throughout society, and it includes essentially the underlying conditions that lead to flourishing for all, including for the least of these. That's how the Bible presents justice. A just society is one that, yes, has the rule of law and is impartial and fair, and where people follow the procedures. That's kind of almost the libertarian vision of justice. And the Bible doesn't stop there. And I think it's really important for political conservatives to hear that that is not the full picture of justice in the Bible. The Bible also includes something that would make, I think, political conservatives a little uncomfortable, that a fully just society is one that enables flourishing for all. And that gets a bit more into the left wing. Of course, we can still have a debate about what is the most effective policy program to make that happen. But I do think it's right to think of justice in those terms for Christians to recognize that justice includes overall conditions of flourishing.
No, that's good. That's good. I will make sure and link that book in the show notes from Keller. I think that'd be a great one for us all to sort of spend some time with, right, as we think about the call to be just people, you know, and even the confrontation of God, of his people in the Old Testament, is very much around how we are speaking to bringing the alien in, you know, caring for the poor, like, you know, not exploiting them for our own gain, you know.
So let's tack back to the other side.
Sure.
It's true the Bible says we should care for the sojourner and the alien and the orphan and the widow. Does that mean we can just directly apply that to our immediate context and say, therefore, we should have open borders and allow unrestricted immigration? No, that's not quite how you apply the Bible. I think one way we apply it is to say that immigrants, including illegal immigrants, are made in the image of God and deserve to be treated humanely. Right? Family separation policy, I think, is inhumane and unrighteous. Even for illegal immigrants, it is a wicked policy in my view, right? I think it's totally legitimate to enforce a border. There's nothing unlawful or unrighteous about enforcing borders. That's a thing that countries do, and right. you can't have sort of sovereignty without that. And so, can we enforce a border? Yes. Should we enforce it humanely? Yes, we should. That's, I think, how you think through these things with a biblical framework.
Yeah, no, I think that's really helpful in a great way for us to, yeah, a great framework for us to think through some of that stuff. So much good stuff. Thank you. I would love to pick your brain about sort of the next maybe part of your trajectory. I know we've kind of like bounced around, but just being somebody who works on foreign policy, who's done that from like an intelligence level, I've never talked to somebody who's had that experience. So do you mind just kind of talking to me about what that even sort of looks like and your experiences?
Yeah. So when I was in the Army, I was in military intelligence, which means it was my job to kind of study where the bad guys were, study how they think, and then tell the commander where they were and how to go get them.
Yeah.
And then after the Army, I transitioned pretty quickly to the civilian intelligence, working for the CIA, doing a pretty similar job, but at the strategic level rather than the tactical level. Sat at a desk there in Langley for, I guess it was 4 or 5 years before they detailed me over to the White House. Loved it. Really fun job. Really interesting stuff. Let's see. I was not a operator. I was not working in the clandestine service.
Okay.
I will say that in thinking about just war, I think that much of what I wrote in that book about just war is applicable to intelligence activities, right? So you can apply the same framework generally to just spying and just covert action. So I think that there are conditions in which spying is entirely ethically permissible, right? Lying, cheating, and stealing, you can do that in the service of your country under the right conditions. And I think, by the way, the United States and most democracies meet those conditions quite often. I do have some quibbles here and there. I think that spying on allies is actually wrong. I think we shouldn't do it. And I'm in a small minority in that. I think most people would think I'm nuts for saying that. But I think it's wrong to spy on allies. So again, I think it's there are times and ways in which you can be ethical as you go about espionage and covert action.
Yeah, that's good. So what was it like sort of being in the White House? I mean, and advising on sort of what's going on overseas? Like, how does that even work, or what does that look like?
I'll put it this way. I could have stayed and worked 30, 40 years in the agency and done something different every 3 to 5 years and had a varied and interesting career. So it's a large community, the intelligence community, and it's got a lot of different stuff. They need people from all backgrounds, right? I was just an intelligence analyst, political science degree, but they can make use of businessmen and lawyers and doctors and technology. They really need computer scientists and hackers and inventors. Like everybody, they need everybody. So to your listeners out there, if you're interested in public service and you've got an interesting background or consider it, especially if you're right now an undergraduate or graduate student. It's a great way to serve your country. I'll give it a maybe 70-80% endorsement, not 100%, because there are, as with anything in life, there's some ethical dilemmas and there's some tense spots. And I think Christians would have to be a little bit careful in watching what they get into, because there are internal safeguards, but I would not rely on them. I'd rely on your own conscience, guided by the word of God, to really keep you on the straight and narrow. I'll just say that there's some things that I wouldn't fully endorse. I'll put it
that way.
Yeah, you're asking me what it's like. It's cool. I loved it. I really don't want to exaggerate myself. The national security establishment is big, and there's only a handful of people who really count. And the president and secretary of defense, it's the small people around them, small circle of people around them. I had a chance to give briefings in the Situation Room, to be in the Oval once or twice. So was it neat? It was really neat. I wanted to give the briefing that changed the decision, that changed the course of the war, that led to the more just and lasting peace in the world. It didn't happen. So I walked away from those 10 years. To be very frank with you, Curry, I walked away feeling pretty burnt out and just discouraged, because I felt like I hadn't made a difference. And it was a little challenging to look at 10 years of my life and say, what difference did that make? And I think the answer is that we're not called to like save the world in one briefing or one paper or even one career. I think we're called to exercise faithfulness where we are, to do every task in the most excellent way we can, to tend and keep the garden, the little patch of garden we've been given. And for 10 years I had that patch, and it was a great little patch. And I got some fun stories about it. flying helicopters around Afghanistan and whatnot, and having a dinner with a warlord once. Like, these are fun stories. But that was my little patch. I hope I did well. At the end of the day, I think as I walk away from that patch, it looks pretty overridden with weeds, and it can be discouraging sometimes to reflect on that. And yet, if I didn't weed that patch, maybe it'd be even worse than it is now. I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's helpful. I've been doing some reflecting. My job was at Starbucks, not in the CIA. So, you know, there's a little bit of a different context, but just even looking back at your career path and just sort of, I think work is very emotional. I did a little writing on this yesterday, and like, we can't help but bring our emotions into our work. It's mm-hmm. who we are in a lot of ways, even though it's not our only identity or main identity, but yeah, it can be really hard to reflect on those things and feel like we aren't making some difference. But I feel like we have some sort of like pie in the sky sort of like thing that should be happening. And God is more concerned with teaching us about ourselves and making us more like him than he is with us changing the war with, with a briefing or, a latte or something,
Another Tim Keller book. This one's called Every Good Endeavor. Mm. And it's a theology of work. And a helpful book, kind of walks us through the biblical theology of it. Again, starting with Genesis, tending and keeping the garden, but then also Genesis 3, the thorns and the thistles. Right. I think we should always expect that in every work we do, we should seek to be faithful stewards of the little patch of garden God has given us to tend. And we should thoroughly expect there to be frustrations and thorns and thistles. And also, by the way, temptations. Job like the jobs I've worked, there's so many temptations to pride and idolatry of achievement and having an overly high estimation of oneself. And so we need to be careful about those things as well. So it's a challenge, I think, in every career field. It really is.
Yeah, that's a really good word and an important way to think about that. Before we got on, you would sort of talked about maybe like reflecting on sort of how the war has gone down, or sort of like the aftermath maybe of the war. Do you think that there's some disconnect for Americans from the war just because it was fought like over there and not in our, we never saw much of what was going on, I guess.
Yes. There's a pretty big disconnect between the civilian world and the military world.
Yeah.
The percentage of Americans who serve in the armed forces is close to an all-time low. Mm. I think it actually is an all-time low since World War II.
Wow.
And the percentage of Americans who have been veterans is also shrinking quite fast. Mm. In the World War II era, I think 10% of the country was under arms on active duty. And of course, we had a draft for a while.
Yeah.
We don't need to go back to that, to those numbers, but it would be, I'm actually in favor of some version of the draft. I really am, because I think it'd be good to require some service of our young people. And it's a way of building a common experience. It's a way of building a attachment to the country as a thing, as a corporate entity, as a group identity. Mm. And it's a way of mingling people from diverse walks of life. So I think actually could be good for our country, for our shared sense of what it means to be an American. If we had something like a draft again, I actually read somebody once suggested a draft just of the rich. Because honestly, people from the working class, middle class, working class, they continue to join the military because right. oftentimes it's the best employment out there. But if you draft just the middle class and the rich, that's what we kind of need to do to give people a common experience across class, across social location.
Right.
So that might not be a bad idea.
Mm. That's interesting. It's interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but I mean, it makes sense. Like, yeah, that's that's, so kind of looking back, I guess, at sort of the war and, where we're still at with all of that stuff, how do you sort of look back at sort of, I don't know how we did or the aftermath of all of that. And
the United States never missed an opportunity to make a mistake in Afghanistan.
Mm, interesting.
As I often say, when we look back at the war and we're going on close to 20 years now, there's very little I would look at and say, there's a model for how we should do things in the future. I can see pockets of success here and there. And the one mistake we haven't made is leaving, right? We still got about I think 2,500 troops, very, very small, 2,500 troops, very small number. It's essentially the smallest we've been since, I think, 2002 or 2003. We ramped up pretty high in 2009, 10, 11. President Obama started pulling us out. President Trump continued that trend. If there's one thing that Obama and Trump agreed on, it was time to get out of Afghanistan.
Right.
And I think that it's a bad idea to leave completely because there are still bad guys there. And it's a good idea to stay there and keep the lid on that if we can. Look, if I could do everything over again, I would say much more earlier on. President Bush did not do much in the way of reconstruction or stabilization in those first 5 years. That was a mistake. He changed his mind, to his credit, started ramping things up in 2007 and 8. It's a bit too late. Obama came in, ramped things up a lot, but he also put a deadline on it and said, hey, I'm going to give you 18 months, then we're gone. That was a huge mistake. And so we've been withdrawing ever since. And President Trump briefly thought about kind of reversing things. He loosened the rules of engagement, but then he also struck that peace deal with the Taliban, which is not a peace deal. It will not lead to peace. It is more like a surrender deal, to be very blunt. The United States has been leaving while the Taliban have reneged on their obligations under that agreement. And so this is what it looks like to lose the war. We're leaving, they're staying, and they're continuing to fight. That means we're losing. That was a 20-year history of the war in Afghanistan in 30 seconds.
Yeah, it very well done, and grieving at the same time, you know?
Yeah. If you hear a bit of kind of resignation in my voice, it's because I'm sort of tired of fighting this battle year after year. I've been saying the same thing. And when Trump struck the deal with the Taliban in just a year ago, almost a year ago this week, it was sort of almost the final nail in the coffin. The final nail will be when we implement that agreement and leave. But that agreement it put into letters what we had actually been doing since about 2012 anyway. So Trump was formalizing what our policy actually was. And it breaks my heart. I would be righteously angry if I had the energy for it. I think we all should be up in arms. We're walking away. We're leaving the Afghans who fought by our side for 20 years. We're handing the country over to the Taliban. It's making America less safe. Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State will return. The Taliban will either take over the country or plunge half of it into civil war. There's nothing good about the Taliban deal we struck a year ago and everything bad. So I would hope that President Biden would reject it and start from scratch. I doubt he will, but that's what he should do.
What is the impetus for that, do you feel like? Is it like sort of public pressure to no longer be in the war or, yeah?
No, there's no sizable anti-war movement in the United States against the war in Afghanistan. Not even close to what there was during Vietnam when literally millions of people were marching in the streets against the war. Right. Not even in Iraq, which was a much smaller anti-war movement, but there was a pretty strong movement in Congress to try to defund the war effort and stuff. There's nobody who's really opposed to it. People are just bored and tired, and I think they've lost faith in it. That was the problem, I think, with the Obama administration. They had the right policy for about a year, and they lost faith because it's hard. You know, toughen up. Foreign policy is hard. War is hard. And I think the war turned out to them to be harder and longer and more expensive than they expected it to be. And so they're like, you know what we want to do? This is taking up too much of our bandwidth. They wanted to focus on healthcare. They wanted to focus on energy, the environment, domestic stuff, nation building at home, as Obama said. And so they did not want to continue investing a lot of resources in the effort, and they started pulling out. And Trump was the anti-war movement. Like he said, we're going to end the endless wars, which is a really misleading trope. And he, under his rhetoric of putting America first, said that meant that we should pull troops home, even though it does the opposite. Actually, keeping troops over there helps keep the lid on the bad guys over there and helps keep the target off of our backs here at home. So I have very little good to say about Trump's approach to the effort.
That's hard, I guess. And I've had none of the experience that you have had. I think I should probably confess just my pure ignorance about foreign policy sort of in general, you know, and I tend to think that I'm probably not alone in that ignorance. It just seems like maybe too hard to be concerned with, but that feels like just a cop out. You know what I mean? I don't want to, or yeah. I don't know what it is, but would you agree that that's sort of a general way that most Americans sort of approach foreign policy or thinking about foreign policy?
Yeah, most Americans don't know much about the world outside of our shores. The problem starts in grade school because I think our schools don't teach a whole lot about the world. There's also a problem with, to be blunt, American chauvinism. It's true that America is a great country and maybe the greatest in the world, maybe the greatest in world history. But even if that's true, there's 194 other countries in the world, and they're diverse and beautiful and wonderful places to learn about. And shame on us for being uninterested in the world, particularly when the world is also full of dangerous things, and we should be aware of them so we can learn how to combat them intelligently. Americans have this habit of often ignoring the world until it's a problem, and then once there's a problem, we kind of march in, guns blazing, and stomp all over everything, when that's not often the best way to solve the problems. There's sometimes more perhaps surgical ways of intervening that are more effective in the long term. I think it's like less than half of Americans actually have a passport or have ever been outside the country. Obviously, I teach international affairs at a university, so I'm a big fan of some global perspective, and I think it'd be good for Americans to appreciate the world beyond our shores, both as just a wonderful and beautiful place to explore, and also often the source of some dangers we need to be aware of.
Yeah, that's good. I've never been out of the country, I'll confess. So, you know, that probably leads into some of that ignorance that I've been talking about. But like when Trump shows up, right, and has this sort of America first policy, right? I mean, I think for most people, that's like, yeah, of course, America first, right? Like not really realizing the implications of it. But I feel like we don't even know how to like how to think through and critique those sorts of things. So I guess for people out there in that position too, like how can we go about as Christians thinking Christianly about foreign policy?
Yeah. So first thing I want to say about America First is that, look, I can agree with the slogan. I think that when the United States government sets out to define its interests, it should rightfully prioritize the interests of America. Sure. That's a true statement because it's funded by the American taxpayer and it's staffed by the American citizens who work for the government and the military. And so, yes, we should actually put America First. Trump is a demagogue who uses words to deceive people into buying into essentially an alternate social reality. And so the way he used that slogan, America First, was deeply deceptive and wrong. I think, for example, Trump often complained about our alliances and said, we need to put America first and therefore we should maybe get out of our alliances. See, I think that's exactly backwards. I think alliances serve America's interests.
Right.
And if you truly want to put America first, you should stay in our alliances because they help protect us.
Right? Right.
That's my response. And that's true for most of what President Trump said and did during his 4 years. You just can't take his words at face value. Okay, your question is, how do we as Christians think about the world and think about foreign policy?
Yeah.
Let's just go back to the garden once again and talk about tending and keeping. Right? If we tend and keep each patch of the world we've been given to steward, the same is true of kind of the world. Much of foreign policy is simply fairly normal, fairly anodyne work of tending and keeping the garden of international order. And so most of the time, that's not fighting a war. It's just kind of upkeeping diplomatic relationships and trade relationships and international institutions. It's normal and it can be kind of boring, but thank God that there's boring work to be done because the alternative is exciting stuff like
right.
wars.
Yeah.
And we should want a world where it's fairly boring. You know, the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. So, you know, a lot of the work foreign policy is just upkeep. It's maintenance of the garden of world order. Now, world order is a thing. It's a social system, and it's informed by norms, by ideas, beliefs, and values. And I think it's actually really important that we try to make them the right values, right? We live in a world, and this is where maybe many Americans don't actually understand this because we've all grown up in this world. If you're a fish, you have no idea what the ocean is.
Right?
We're the fish, and the ocean is world order as it has existed since World War II.
Yeah.
And we have no idea about it because we've lived in it for three generations.
Mm.
But the world order we live in is stamped and characterized by our values, by America's values, by American and European values. I'm going to use the word liberal. But when I say liberal values, I don't mean the Democratic Party. I mean classical liberalism, the values of John Locke and the American founders, right? And right now, world order is still primarily informed by those classically liberal values of accountable governance, the rule of law, even human rights informs much of the world. And we should be very grateful for that, because the alternative is Chinese-led world order. And I promise you, you're not going to like Chinese-led world order,
right,
or Russian-led world order, or even worse, the absence of any kind of order and the presence of chaos and global conflict and global war and all that. And so the vision of the world I'm sketching out is what Trump criticized when he talked about the globalists. Well, you know, I'm going to defend globalism and say that globalism is the victory of American ideals, right? When American ideals predominate around the world, it creates a system of ordered liberty, of relatively free trade, of open seas and protecting the commons and cooperative security among our like-minded democratic allies. Those are all wonderful things. And if you don't like it, I promise you, you're going to like the absence of them even less, because that is a terrible world to live in. It's the world of 1939, and we do not want to go back that way.
Yes. Yes. So much yes. There's so much there. This is probably an aside, but I've been listening to a podcast called Behind the Bastards, but they've been doing a series on the insurrectionists, like the fascist sort of insurrections from even like I'm listening to Spain right now, which I didn't realize, like leading to the Spanish Civil War. And, you know, just like so much turmoil going on there from Mussolini to, you know, obviously Hitler and all of that stuff. And just, yeah, I think that's a really important thing for us to think about. Are there places that we could go to get like good information on like what's actually going on in the world?
Yeah. Well, I'm a contributing editor of a magazine called Providence, which is a magazine of Christianity, American foreign policy. And so I'd encourage your listeners to go to providencemag.org, and that, It's not news. It's more like commentary. It's analysis from a Christian perspective, usually about things going on around the world. You'll read a lot about international religious freedom in other countries. You'll read about America's role in the world from a Christian realist standpoint, from the standpoint of thinkers like Reinhold Niebuhr and others. You'll read a lot about just war, and you'll read about oftentimes the plight of Christian minorities in other countries. Right. So that's the kind of stuff that Providence touches on.
That's awesome.
It also has touched on this debate about nationalism and nationalism around the world and in America. And one thing I like about Providence is that it doesn't have what one party line on this. I have my own views. I think nationalism is generally bad, but there are some voices in Providence that are a little bit more favorable. And so we can host a congenial debate among Christians who still have different perspectives on the nature of world order and on how nationalism plays into that. So Providence is a great place to go. And look, if you want to learn about the world, subscribe to a good newspaper. I'm going to be a heretic here and say, subscribe to the Washington Post. is it liberal? Yes. Come on, get over it. We all know that the big newspapers are liberals and New York Times, but like that's not the end of the world. And you can read and edit out the bias. You cannot insist on reading media only that echoes your own ideological preferences. That's a recipe for ideological blindness. So read a good newspaper, and the Post is good. And they've got pretty good global coverage. The Times has good coverage too. I don't subscribe to them because I can't stand them. Despite what I just said, I can't stand them. My paper choice is the Post. I love the Atlantic magazine as well.
Yeah.
They're a little bit less global, but you will find some stuff there occasionally. So there's a variety of places you can go.
Yeah. I think that's really helpful. I mean, even just knowing like what resources out there are good is just like, it's complicated. Yeah. I think, there's so much. Yeah. Paul, this has been like drinking from a fire hose, and I just thank you so much. This was like a incredible conversation, and I benefited from it, greatly. So,
I had a lot of fun, and I'm happy to, as you can tell, I have no problem talking. So if you ever want to continue the conversation in any direction, I know we covered so much terrain.
Yeah.
You just raised the Capitol riot on the 6th, and I have several hours of talk. I'd love to get into that. Particularly, you saw the Christian imagery there. You know, there's this Christian imagery in that and the Jericho March earlier, and I'm very worried, deeply concerned about the prevalence of Christianity or professed Christianity mixing in with some fairly extreme elements in our political discourse. And so that might be worth a whole separate conversation. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great. Let's continue that conversation for sure, because I can't imagine not wanting to talk to you about when the nationalism book comes out. And, you know, I want to be helping you get these resources out to people. You know, I think it's important, and I appreciate it. Are you okay if we jump into our final two questions as we sort of wrap up here?
Yeah, that's fine. Go for it.
Okay, so my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Strangest? Possibly being a dad. Do you have kids?
Three
kids. How old are your kids?
She's about to turn 11, 9, and 4.
Yeah, so mine are I gotta get this right. They're having birthdays here very shortly.
I'm right in the same boat.
They will turn 12, 11, and 8.
Oh, perfect.
So right in the same age range. Yeah. And so, you know, being a dad involves everything from tutoring fourth grade math, you know, years ago changing diapers, and building Legos together, and training our little puppy together, and entering their imaginative world. Mm. Playing dolls with my daughter, or going on a hike, walking with them through their scouting adventures, a part of some scouts. You know, I'm cheating on your question, but being a dad is so varied, and you never know what it's going to be every day. Someday it is just putting out fires and dealing with tantrums, and some days it is the sweetest, most amazing thing in the world. So I think it's kind of weird that it's so varied that way.
No, I totally agree. And no one's ever said that one, but I think you're right. I think, I think that's good. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
I already recommended the book, Every Good Endeavor by Keller. Mm. That might be, go read that book is maybe one piece of advice.
Yeah.
I think I might echo what you and I talked about earlier, how the gospel is more than individual salvation. Look, N.T. Wright wrote his book, Surprised by Hope, and he says that evangelism sometimes is a matter of, I think he says something like spreading examples of justice and beauty and truth. That can be an entry gate. If you use your work to build examples of justice, beauty, and truth, people might look at you and say, why? There's your entry gate for evangelism, for I guess the more conventionally understood evangelism. So maybe that's the advice I'd give, is try to understand bringing God's kingdom in more than just propositional evangelism terms. It's not just about handing out tracts, which is not to disparage handing out tracts. That's a good thing. But it is about that first step of building examples of truth, justice, and beauty in the world, which gives you that entry point to explain the author of truth and justice and beauty.
Amen. I think that's amazing advice. Paul, it was so nice to get to talk to you and meet you, and I really appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Craig. Appreciate it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Paul and just talking about justice and just how we think about how we are citizens in this country. I think that's really important stuff to talk about. There's so much there. Paul does have a book called Just War and Ordered Liberty. If you're interested in sort of thinking about just war theory, I picked it up. I'm going to be working through that, excited about that. He also has a book on nationalism coming out, which I think is going to be a great benefit to us, to understanding sort of what's going on in this world, and hoping I can bring him back on to talk about that. But make sure you're following him on Twitter, just so you know when some of this stuff is coming out, and just some of this thinking. Like, it's important to follow people that think deeply about these things, and I think Paul is a great resource for that. So now is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app and leave a rating and review. Just helps get the word out about the podcast, and I greatly appreciate it. So I just personally thank you for taking time to do that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.